world, and welcome to the Flyover Startups podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Poehler. Each week, we talk to founders who are building their businesses outside of Silicon Valley in the so-called Flyover states. Today, we talk to David Sherry of Brandswell and Death to the Stock Photo, based in Columbus, Ohio. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, Pat. How you doing?
Pretty good. How was my intro?
It's perfect, man. You got it down now. I'm happy to see it.
So, David, let's start about your background. Where did you grow up?
Sure. I'm from Toledo, and I am currently living in Columbus, Ohio. So it's about 2.5 hours northwest of here, and I don't get home too often. I've been pretty busy lately, but it's good to be able to be a little bit close to home so I can get home for the holidays and stuff like that.
Cool. Well, how did you get into entrepreneurship? Was your family, anyone in your family, an entrepreneur? Was it something you've always been interested in?
I think it was something that I kind of knew for a long time that I wanted to do my own thing. I don't think I really understood what that meant until I got to Ohio State, actually. So I actually went to Kentucky my freshman year and ended up transferring to come back a little bit closer to home what I think is a better school, so good decision.
As a Louisville Cards fan, I completely agree.
But anyway, so I got to Ohio State, and I still think I knew that, you know, I wasn't the best in school, and I think I kind of had seen a lot of problems around me that I wanted to solve, and I think I knew that it was like it would be fun for me to go out and do something that changes something or changes the rules a little bit. But it wasn't until I got to Ohio State and met some students at the Business Builders Club, which is the entrepreneurship group at Ohio State, that really opened up my perspective on what was possible. And I think, you know, even though I knew that I wanted to be in entrepreneurship realm, I didn't know what was possible. And then I get to this club meeting, and it's a Business Builders Club, which is all student entrepreneurs. And I start meeting kids who are, you know, 18 that already have apps on the App Store and are making money every week from the App Store off this thing they've built. And it was just kind of mind-blowing to me that people my age were doing things already. And so that's really where the change happened for me. Was I think I thought, you know, I graduate, maybe I work for a bit, and then sometime down the line I could try doing my own thing. But here are these kids at Ohio State that are 2 years younger than me, and they're already making money solving problems. And so that was just a big shift for me. And really all my growth, I think, was kind of incubated in that group at Ohio State.
Well, that's interesting. You know, and I was just going to ask you about the Business Builders Club, and you later became the vice president of the organization, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a group of go-getters. And I think it's really, you know, the people you spend time with, it's so important that you're aligned with people that push you and challenge you to become something better or to grow. And it's impossible not to in that club because everyone's doing more than you. And so it's, you know, you get there and you're just like, God, all these people already have businesses. And, you know, a really good buddy of mine still, Nils Root, he was running a t-shirt company that was popular on campus. And we put together this poverty summit every spring. And a small group of students raised, I think, like 28 grand, brought in speakers from across the country and this year across the world. And they just do it. Yeah, they just do amazing things. And when you see people like that, you're like, okay, I need to step my game up and start something. So every quarter at Ohio State, they have a pitch competition. And so my first go at entrepreneurship was in one of these pitch competitions where I tried to build, you know, a small little company that I could then pitch for a small amount of seed money. And I actually ended up getting second place my first time in the idea pitch competition. And, I was kind of hooked from there, I guess.
What was the idea that you pitched?
It was kind of funny. I had an idea for – I was interning at Jack Thread. So one of the cool things about Business Builders Club is there's some great alumni. Jason Ross, who started Jack Threads that later got bought by Thrillist. He was a member of BBC back in the, you know, maybe 6 years ago. So I actually ended up interning there because he came in to speak as like an ex-BBCer. Interning at Jack Threads, and I'm constantly around like fashion and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's a men's online retail brand. And I kind of saw a need in the market for custom or very fashionable Apple cover products. So laptop covers, iPod cases, stuff like that. So my first business that I pitched actually was hand-knit covers for laptops. And I partnered with a lady in town who actually knit them herself. and it was going to have this whole international feel to it, and it didn't really go anywhere, obviously, but it was a good way to get into it, you know.
That's cool. So just being a part of the BBC and in a way, just having that peer group and that peer support, you know, fostered and maybe molded your entrepreneurship, like, you know, just the desire, and then being around your, you know, similar peers just kind of helped you mold it.
Yeah, I honestly, I feel like I owe like almost everything to BBC. And one of the really cool things about the club was every Tuesday we had an entrepreneur come in and speak about their experiences. So it's kind of like what you're doing on this show a little bit. You get to hear from entrepreneurs in the community every Tuesday talking about their problems, what they overcame. And so my role as vice president was actually booking the speakers. So for an entire year, every Tuesday, I booked an entrepreneur to come in and speak to our group. And so for my network, that was great. But also after every talk, we'd all grab beers at a local bar on campus and just talk about business. So like every single Tuesday, it was just this awesome refresher where you knew that Tuesday night you were going to be talking just about business, and just amazing discussions happened after those meetings. And that's something I think I missed being out of school a bit.
Yeah. When you were at Ohio State and being around all these entrepreneurs and sort of hearing stories in the valley of, you know, young people, bright young people quitting college and going to startups or founding a company, was it difficult to stick it out in college? And
it was. Yeah, I definitely think it was. Not so much of the course load was that difficult. It was more that I started feeling more and more stretched. And so I got after my first few kind of random business ideas that I kind of attempted at, I did have some things that started moving forward, even though I'm not really still doing them today. But I ended up spending a lot more time on working on these projects that I was trying to build, freelancing in town for some different startups in the area. And as soon as you get this taste of what real life is like, you know, quote unquote, I think I saw that I actually enjoyed it more than my classwork. And so, you know, especially, and not to dog business school or anything like that, but I felt like it was a few years behind what I was seeing on maybe the cutting edge of some of these startups. So whereas we're really diving into social and SEO, a lot of classes didn't really touch on that yet. They were more base level. And as you grow into your niche, you really are looking for those niche details, you know? So like I didn't want to breeze over what Facebook means to business. I wanted like really specific details. And I did have some great classes. I had a class with Rich Langdale, who's a venture capitalist in town. And that was fantastic. And, you know, that allowed me to work in groups and have one-on-one time with a venture capitalist twice a week. So that was really valuable. But I'd say I felt stretched towards the end of my you know, school experience.
Yeah. So, you know, feeling stretched, you know, there was always this thought of, well, I'm going to graduate and I'm going to stick it out. So there was, did you have any moments of, you know, just being stretched and it's like, hey, I'm already, you know, I'm first name basis with a lot of entrepreneurs here and, you know, some VCs and,
you know,
why do I need to stay?
So, you know, this is pretty funny, but it's something that I still remember at one of the meetings in BBC. Luke Barbara, who's kind of a mentor of mine, he's only like 2 years older than me, but, you know, he had been doing a lot of stuff. He was president of the club at one time. He came back and he said to everybody, you have a golden ticket being at school, because if you approach anybody and you're a student, especially at Ohio State with its big network, people love talking to you. They love mentoring you. And the minute you get out in the real world, they don't want to help you so much anymore, you know, and people are still open. And I think this, especially Columbus, is super accepting and helpful to entrepreneurs. But that was kind of his message, was as a student, you have this golden ticket of, I can talk to anybody. I can make mistakes. You know, I can reach out to the CEO of some company and I'm just a stupid student. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, can you just, you know, can I just buy you a cup of coffee and hear about what it's like? And so I definitely think I tried to use that to my advantage, and I think it's really solid advice. I'd say the same thing to students now is, there's a definite change when you're out of school as far as people willing to give your time and just accept your mistakes as far as like what you said in an email or how you approach something. They're much more forgiving. So I thought that was great advice, and I think I realized that value in my senior year and hopefully was able to cash in on that golden ticket a little bit, I guess.
Right. Do you think a lot of students at Ohio State, you know, you took a lot of advantage of the sort of out extracurricular activities and the things going on there at the clubs? Is that something that you found common in the business school at Ohio State, or was that, was your group just kind of unique?
I think the group was unique. And I mean, even within the group, it's the 80-20 rule. So, I mean, you see this conference that has 1,000 people attending it, 28 grand raised to get there. And honestly, like, I mean, there's a team of probably 15, 20 people total, but like, when it comes down to it, there was probably 4 people behind that. And so I think even within the group, you know, BBC, everybody in the group is amazing, but I'd say the majority of that work that gets done as far as booking and everything, it's really 5 core people. And that's just consistent year to year. And I think that's a good representative of maybe the school in general and just maybe even life it always kind of is that 80-20 rule where there's some people really overextending and doing a ton, and the rest kind of are involved, but maybe not to the point that some of these other students are.
Yeah. So after graduating, since graduating Ohio State, you've started Brandswell. Can you describe what Brandswell is and what it does for clients?
Sure. So, I graduated in May, and luckily before I had graduated, I'd kind of already started doing some projects along the lines of Brandswell. So it really kind of started out of working with a small kind of PR launch shop in town called the Launch Farm. And I'd been kind of, I guess, moonlighting on some of the projects he'd been working on. And the funny thing about Brandswell is, okay, essentially what Brandswell is it's my freelance brand, and it's kind of full stack marketing. So anything I can do to help brands communicate or build an audience or engage with their audience, I try to do that. So within the realm of that, I've picked up video, photography, social, and really they're all just methods of communication. So I don't see video as being any different than Twitter. I don't see Facebook as being that much different than photography. I think that they're a means of communicating with an audience. And so what's been interesting about Brandswell is a lot of the work that I've done has been taking on projects where I didn't actually have a command in that space, but building a skill set so that I could support the needs of clients. So I actually never did video until, you know, maybe late last year. I attended a startup weekend, and instead of taking on a startup that weekend, I decided I wanted to learn video. And so my project was a video. On Sunday, I showcased that video. And honestly, the next week, I had a $500 gig shooting video for someone I already had a relationship with. But and you know, if I look back at that video, it's really bad. I don't think it's very good. But that's kind of what's been interesting about Brandswell is I've been trying to – I kind of am taking on a lot of things before I'm ready for it. And that's really what's built out the brand itself is now I can offer video really, and photography is the same thing. You know, you can't really take on more clients with a project until you've done it before. And so you just have to dive in and do it, I guess.
Is there a fear, when a client approaches you, say for a video project or a photography project or something you haven't done before, like, is there this fear of like, oh gosh, what if I screw this up? And,
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's there. I think the right answer is starting before you're ready, because if you wait too long, then, you know, you'll never be ready. You know, if you're trying to perfect your skill, I do look back at some projects and think, you know, I can do a lot better work than that now. But at the same time, I knew that my price was also cheaper than most people in town. And there was a few projects I'd been doing before school and after that were free or a trade of services. So some of my early projects were either a trade or free or big, you know, price reduction. And it's kind of like you're paying for what you're going to get.
Yeah.
But I think you just have to, dive into it. And it's amazing what you can learn in like a year. You know, I feel like you can go from not being a photographer to calling yourself a photographer a few months later. You just have to do it a bunch, I guess.
Yeah. There's a similarity in development, you know, I've had a number of, well, pretty much every project I'm on, you know, we, as a developer, we don't know the complete ins and outs. There's always some aspect we've never done before, I find in most projects, or at least the ones I take.
Yeah.
And it's, and it is, you know, you get paid to learn. So it's, it's interesting, seeing someone apply that to a non-development type career and apply it to marketing. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just about taking that leap before you're ready, but it is worrisome. And I mean, still to this day, projects that come up, some of it is even just equipment. And that's one of the barriers for something like video is like, I have to borrow from friends or, you know, I'm using a microphone that I've never used before the first time in a live project. And so that gets kind of scary, but I think ultimately it makes you learn super fast because you have a client on the hook. And so it really, you know, if you're learning by yourself and you're just taking your time, that's one way to do it. But if you just dive in, it's going to force you to knock something out and learn quick. So that's been good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so another piece that, you know, maybe I'll jump ahead here, but another piece that's been really fun about Brandswell is, and this is, if I was going to give out maybe a piece of advice to anybody, not that I feel like I, you know, have that much of that, but one of the things that has really sold my services of Brandswell actually isn't my previous projects, but it's been projects that I've done for fun. That are just quirky and I just kind of came up with and did quickly. And that's what's really attracted, I think, people to my brand. So,
like what kinds of projects?
So an example of that is like, about once a month, I try to do something kind of just quirky and random. And so, I had this idea in town and I was working on a site called ColumbusStartups.com that kind of organized and, you know, powered the startup community. And I kind of found this partnership with a company in town called Trident Design, and they had all these awesome power squids, which were these like, you know, power strips that were kind of, they looked like a squid in shape.
Yeah. I've seen them at Mission Coffee. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. So and that leads right into what I was going to say. And so with Columbus Startups, it was like, it was bootstrapped and it was like, how are we going to get the word out for Columbus Startups without a budget? And so I actually borrowed, or I guess they donated about 10 of those power strips to me, and I put Columbus Startups sticker on the power strips and then donated them to local coffee shops.
Whoa.
So that every time somebody was plugging in their laptop, we were unofficially powering their workday. And so that was marketing that I did for free for that site that kind of was just quirky and weird. And, you know, it looks good on Trident because then their product is out in the community. It looks good on Columbus Startups because we were dropping them off at kind of startup hub coffee shops. And so kind of my point is when I tell that story to clients, that's what gives me work. It's not the video I did last month for this other brand. It's, hey, did you notice that, you know, all the coffee shops around town have these power squids with our branding on it? Or, you know, we left a bunch of disposable cameras around the city with this note that said, hey, pick this camera up, take a picture, and leave it where you found it. And then we collected all these photos from random people taken across the city, and it kind of made this awesome, like, hey, here's what, like, Columbus looks like from the eye of everybody. You know, and so just like these random, quirky, weird projects, like I had a newspaper that I came out with that I shipped to some people, and yeah, it's just really about kind of staying weird, I guess, a bit. And these projects have a deadline, so, you know, once I'm done with it, it's out there, and I can kind of go on to the next thing.
That's nice.
But I'd say that my tip would be, if you can tell stories that people will get excited about, that's what's going to sell your business, not so much maybe my past products. Like, that's what clicks in people's minds is, like, that power strip thing. Like, that was pretty cool. Like, yeah. I want to hire this guy, if that makes sense. And you can do these things really cheap. I mean, those cameras that I left around the city, those were $6 a piece. And it makes a lot of impact. And people say, like, whoa, like, it was cool to see the way all these people took pictures from across the city. Or, you know, as advertising, we bought coffees for everybody. I partnered up with another small company in town, and we sponsored the day at a coffee shop by just buying everyone who came in coffee. And we had a little note that said, you know, if you want to thank us, like, you can tweet at us here. But all these people, and it was fun to watch. I mean, you're hanging out at the coffee shop, and everyone's going up to the counter to buy a coffee, and they say, nope, it's on, you know, Brandswell today. No problem.
Wow.
And it was so cheap, you know. I mean, it was like, whatever, $80 or something like that. But that really broke up someone's day. And I think that's what, coming back to your point about social, is when there's so much noise, if you can make somebody pause or if you can break up their day a little bit, that's what they're going to remember. Hmm. So if they're sitting at the park and they notice a camera on the ground with a little note attached to it, that breaks up their day. If they were going to pay for coffee, they no longer have to. That breaks up their day. And I think that's what people are going to remember. And in the world of all the noise, it's the only way to stand out.
Hmm. So it's like, you know, we go about our day and we're on a certain track, right? And like, okay, mm-hmm. well, I'm going to go to the park and have my lunch. And then, you know, I've got 40 minutes to do that. And then I'm back at the office. But then when you see mm-hmm. a camera sitting next to you with a note, it's like, right. whoa, wait a minute, what's this? This isn't yeah. part of the plan.
I think people get like excited when they don't have to go about their day as normal either. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I think that connects with people. And I think that connects with clients as well. I think if you're just pitching your services as, well, we handle your social media accounts and it's this yeah. much per month, you know, and I don't know. I just don't think that it connects as much as a story that someone can tell their friends. I mean, I think a lot of people saw that camera and then took a picture of it or told somebody after they saw them, or, you know, people want to be able to tell fun stories too.
Hmm. So you do a lot of, in addition to those types of projects, you work with brands and social, I imagine, is a part of that. How is social changing the way brands, how companies enforce their brands and control their brands? Is mm-hmm. An adjustment some companies have to get used to?
It's a huge adjustment. I mean, it's difficult. I think the part of it is it's really difficult, and it takes a lot of time to build trust on social. It takes a lot of time to keep up with all of your platforms, because it used to be, you know, that you could just pay for advertising or you'd have a controlled brand because it was all from in-house. Mm-hmm. And now you have to keep up on Twitter, on Facebook, on Pinterest. I mean, it seems like we have a new social network you have to be on every 6 months, right? So mm-hmm. I think it's really difficult for people because there's so many ways you can tell your story now. And I think people are trying to figure out, how can I hack that so that I don't have to spend as much time? But the answer is you just have to spend that much time.
And more and time.
More time than you're used to. And so I think that's been really difficult. I think the other really difficult piece is how real time everything is. And, you know, brands, they have a very specific way that they want to come off to the public. So they have brand guidelines. They want to, especially a brand that's been around for a long time, they want to appear a certain way. But there's so many ways. It's so easy to not appear the way you want now when everything is real time. When you're responding to people all day on social, it's really easy to kind of slip up. Mm-hmm. But I think what brands can do is just embrace it. And if you embrace that it's a little bit more out of your hands now, that's actually what's going to help you leverage and get more content. So yeah. What I'm really interested in right now is the way that you can let your followers or your customers drive your content. Hmm. So what I was saying before is that it's really difficult to keep up with producing content for Twitter, for Facebook, for Pinterest. But I think the answer is, if you can let go and let your customers drive that content and create content for you, if you can let go of that, you know, maybe brand control, your job's going to be easier because they're creating authentic content for you. Hmm. And that's why we've seen a shift onto these hashtag campaigns on something like Instagram, where it's, you know, tweet in or take a picture of this, and then they aggregate that content onto their site. It makes it a lot easier on a brand because, you know, the customers are actually doing the work.
What happens when bad actors get involved? So, you know, stand-up comedians or right. People on Reddit just sort of realize, oh, McDonald's is pushing out this this hashtag promotion around healthy eating. Okay, now right, it's time to create a funny meme around that.
Right. Oh, it's – and that's what brands are so scared of, I think. And, you know, we saw on Reddit – I don't know if you saw the – I think it was the guys from, like, JP Morgan Chase or something.
Oh, gosh, yes.
They did an AMA and just got killed. But I think they need to think about their own context. And I think that if McDonald's – I don't know if it happened, but if McDonald's did try to run a campaign around healthy eating – I think they should know that that's actually stretching their contextual bounds. Mm. And I don't think that people will come after you if you're working within the right frame. I think it's when, I mean, people know what's up. Like, people on social, they know when you're trying to blow some smoke. They know when you're trying to sell to them. And so, I just think people are smarter than maybe some of these brands think. And so McDonald's won't be able to get away with something like that. Hmm. The audience of Reddit won't act nicely to somebody like that because you have to think about the context of that audience. So I think the first thing a brand can do to kind of avoid that is just understand really where your brand is. Don't lie to yourself and say you're a healthy, eating company if everyone's going to freak out about it when you do that. And I think the second thing is just don't feed the trolls. Mm. There's so many examples of when something went wrong and brands try to backtrack and it just gets 10 times worse every time you respond. But there's some really interesting things that have happened. I mean, I've seen, and I can't remember the two companies, but I've seen an example on Facebook where some guy was he was trying to ask for help from a airline company and was kind of getting some negative responses from the airline company. And another airline company actually swooped in on their page and gave the guy a big discount or maybe even a free flight and said, "Hey, we're so sorry they're treating you poorly. We love our customers. Here's a free flight to Europe or something." And the amount of people that like loved what that other airline did was just huge. And so they got so much great exposure. And, you know, if you treat your customers poorly, people will find out. It's transparent now, you know?
That goes back to, that reminds me of Gary Vaynerchuk's The Thank You Economy. He talks about that where, companies can do some interesting things to go above and beyond, you know, and create, really unique experiences. And
It allows you to listen. I think that's Gary's whole thing is that you can now listen to what all of your customers are saying every day. And so it's a way to respond to them. It's back and forth. You're listening to them. You're maybe brightening their day through something. But this could be a good transition for talking about death of the stock.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
I think there's some good kind of case study things I'm working on that relate to this topic. So
let's. Can I ask for the listeners what death of the stock photo is and what it does? What pain point is it trying to solve?
Sure. So we started about 4 months ago, me and a fellow designer, blogger in town named Allie Lehman. And kind of what we wanted to do was just alleviate the pain point of searching and using stock photography. So we'd both gone on iStock and Shutterstock and had a poor experience kind of all the way through from searching for photos to the price point of photos and also just to what they looked like. And yeah, it's really interesting because, Some of these photos that have been on there for about 8 years. But I know tons of photographers in town that have thousands of photos just sitting in their Dropbox account, not being used. And so I kind of just saw this problem of people take, the world globally takes like a billion photos a day. A lot of them are really nice and quality. Why are we paying $50 for an 8-year-old kind of cheesy photo and using it on a site that, you have developers working, slaving away to make this beautiful, every pixel correct site, and then you pay $50 for this photo that just ruins the whole thing. So death of the stock photo is kind of based in that problem, and then the way we wanted to solve it was through generosity. So every month we send a big group of designers, developers, bloggers, freelancers, 10 lifestyle images that we take ourselves within a certain category. And we say, hey, you guys can use this however you want. You can use it on your blog. You can use it for mock-ups on your website. And that's kind of been it so far. We just send out high-quality photography. A lot of it was in our Dropbox already, but we've gotten a lot of people who are pretty pumped about it. So it's been fun watching that grow.
Very cool. So how does that relate to having brands and their audience create the content for them and transition to that?
So a little bit more on death of stock is, I think what we kind of realized was that we want to build this into a brand that really just resonates with creatives. And so it's not even so much about the photos anymore, I think, as we go forward. I think that's a nice value add. But I think our end goal is that these are death to stock photos. They're not iStock photos. Hmm. And it almost kind of relates to something like the way that clothing brands work, where people, you know, most shirts are the same, but you buy into one brand because you like their story. Hmm. And so because death to stock photo inherently is kind of this movement, we see our brand growing into a movement that kind of, you know, and inspires creatives and leads them forward. So we felt like we found a problem that we wanted to lead this group of people who subscribes to our list into changing. Hmm. So to get back to some of the social stuff, I'll tell you a little bit about what we're working on right now that's kind of taking our followers along and giving them tools to help this movement.
So if I'm reading that correctly, you've built up a community of photographers and creatives, and sounds like developers and site owners, mm-hmm. around this movement of, hey, stock photos need to be better. We need to raise the bar.
Yeah.
And so when you, now it seems like you're in a situation where, okay, where do we take this community that we're starting to collect? And this is more of
right.
a movement.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that what we realize is that it is a movement. I think we found a problem and we want to lead people into solving this problem. And I think the difference between a movement and maybe a business or a project is we've seen other people start saying on their Instagram, say, hey, use any of my photos you want if you want to use these for your sites. And we've seen other people doing that. And the difference between us and maybe someone else who's a stock site is we encourage that.
Hmm.
So we're happy that other people are kind of taking this initiative to improve the quality of photography online.
How does that relate with, sorry to interrupt, how does that relate with copyright and is...
There's some interesting stuff around that, and that's why we take all of our own photos, because we keep control. And we do have a lawyer that we work with that makes sure that all of the work that we produce is eligible for that type of use. Okay. So I would say for other people doing that, they need to be conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of circling back, it's we really wanted to assemble these creatives who push for better work. Mm-hmm. So we're not trying to, you know, it's not like we're trying to kill stock photography. We're sending out technically stock photography. We want people to improve the quality of photography online.
I see.
And so we want people to improve their work. We're hoping that designers become their best selves because they have better photos to work with.
Hmm.
That developers who spend all this time pushing, you know, pixels can have a nice photo to go along with that framework that they've built. And so we're really trying to push that movement for them to be their best selves, I guess. But and like I was saying, where I think when other people are doing things to push for this goal, we're happy about it. We're not saying, oh, no, that's competition. We're saying, yes, they're driving for the same end goal we are.
I see. That's the situation if... You know, two, you see one corner and it's filled with, you know, gas stations and repair mm-hmm. shops. And that's actually good in general mm-hmm. for all of the businesses there, because that's the place customers go to when they need, you know, their flat tire changed. So,
yeah. And so I'll get into some of the ways that I was talking about, like as a case study from the topic of having other people help you create your content.
Mm-hmm.
So we realized that, okay, we've got this big list of subscribers, people like the product, but we don't have the supply we need to produce all of the photos that we could. So we're not in Alaska, we're not in Europe. So if we want to produce those type of photos, we can't do that. But what we do have is an audience to share someone's work with.
Wow.
So what's going to start happening in December is we're going to start exposing photographers in other parts of the country or even around the world in turn for them donating their photos and say, hey, if you live in LA, here's so-and-so. He's got a great feed. This month's photos are from him. Hire him if you live in LA and you need a photographer. But it's a way for us to source our supply of content.
Oh, I see.
And even further, I'll kind of push this to something we're doing on social is because it's a movement, we just wrote a manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
So we sat down and thought about, you know, what are we about? What's our manifesto? And the way we're going to roll it out is we've actually started linking up with a bunch of designers across the country to write each line separately of the manifesto in handwritten type.
Hmm.
So we're going to do the first line, and then we're going to post it to Instagram. another designer from, you know, New York is going to do the second line, and we're going to post that to Instagram. And so we're actually sourcing the creation. I mean, we wrote the manifesto, but the design of it and how it looks typed out is going to be mashed together from 8 to 10 designers who all have a specialty in type.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I just think it makes for a better story for our audience. I think they're going to be more engaged with it. It's more collaborative. And honestly, I think every time we email people, we're curious. We're asking questions. We're saying, does this manifesto resonate with you? Do our photos resonate with you? How are the stories we're telling connect with what you're working on? And so our whole movement is collaborative. And I think it's really going to help source a lot of our content moving forward. So I foresee a lot of what we're going to do 6 months from now is actually just aggregating other creatives' work and displaying it for a large audience to see. And it's a win-win for both of us.
This is an interesting concept. It reminds me of Seth Godin when he talks about building a tribe. Like, you're leading a tribe of people around improving online content. And, you know, that starts with stock photography.
Yeah.
And you're building your tribe instead of building a specific product, which is very interesting.
Exactly. And actually what I think we're going to become, and what's super interesting, is I think it's going to become death to stock. And okay. I think stock means fine. Stock is standard. Mm. And so death to stock is people who are doing above average work in any creative space. And so we want to lead this movement of people doing above average work. And some of that is us supplying the tools for them, like high quality photography. Maybe we get into type or something. But that's the whole idea behind the movement. And the best thing we can do is connect people who are part of the tribe, as you said, give them tools to improve their lives and work, and give them the means to push forward the mission. So we're just greasing the engine. We're pushing the ball, and once it's going, we want our tribe to really push the movement. And we're going to kind of keep the reins on it and aggregate and you know, keep it so that everyone can view what's happening. But that's the way I see our brand. And that's the mission behind Death to Stock.
And that's cool. And this is a fully you and your co-founder are funding this yourself.
Yeah. It's completely bootstrapped. I mean, luckily, the good thing about today is it doesn't take too much. We've only used an email list so far. We've got a landing page. Essentially free. Our biggest cost is like $150 a month for MailChimp or something, which is kind of a problem. We need to figure out how to curb that. But
yeah,
I mean, that's what's cool is we can build this all over social. And because it's a mission first, Instagram is a perfect place to tell stories. So we want to continue telling stories and building that audience and hopefully grow into something that's death to stock, where it's just this big community of creatives that are pushing for better work.
Are you focused on Instagram right now just because that is the social network for sharing photography? That's kind of where your audience is congregating.
I think as a brand, if I was going to like have another takeaway here, I think you need to think about the utility of every network. And I think that sometimes people are doing the wrong utility on the wrong network, right? So an example is, I don't think you should ever try to sell anything on Instagram. I think Instagram is purely a place to tell stories. I think our Twitter account is support for answering questions, Q&A. People have problems. That's what Twitter's for. We don't need to build a giant audience. We want that to be a quick response system.
I see.
Pinterest, if we are selling things, is great for selling things. You can link right to a page. So I think you want to think about the context and what your tone is as well on every single network. And for us, Instagram, it does make sense because of photos. But yeah, I think Instagram is purely telling stories. Twitter is purely support. Facebook is kind of an aggregate of the bunch. And Pinterest is for long-term content and maybe linking to some purchase pages.
That's interesting. It's been a while since anyone has mentioned Pinterest as a, you know,
it's huge. Nobody knows about it. It's like the third biggest driver of traffic and sales. So it's crazy, but it has a lot of value. I don't know a ton still, but yeah, people leave it out. And I mean, Tumblr too. People need to remember there's a lot of people on there. But yeah, thinking about the context too. I mean, who Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, I mean, how did you sort of discover that, you know, these networks and more specifically, I guess, their utility? Was it just a lot of trial and error? Was it going out and really searching and drawing those connections? How did you?
And it's something that kind of only clicked like literally 2 weeks ago, I think, that I realized that Pinterest, the, you know, like it or not, and the, obviously this is the, it's not the, the rule, but it's mostly women who are interested in fitness, fashion, you know. And so once I started thinking about networks as who's behind them, Instagram is highly creative, photographers, people interested in design. Facebook's a bit more broad. Like, I think once I started thinking about who's actually on these networks and what they respond to, I stopped forcing content onto networks that weren't going to respond well to it. It's like, if you're putting a bunch of horrible looking images on Instagram, it's just not going to take off, right? So thinking about it like that and saying, who's on this platform, who's listening, and how can I supply them with content that they want to be engaging with, that's the biggest thing. I mean, you shouldn't try to force, especially a mission or anything. We don't try to force anything. It should be something that people are ready to respond to or ready to engage with.
Is it easy to tell when you've hit that sweet spot? I mean, is it in the conversion numbers? Is it in the increase in signups, or is it just more of a gut feeling of like, okay, I've hit it?
I think it takes a while. I think that's, again, we talked about this earlier, but I think it takes a while to get there, and we spend a lot more time, I think, than people would think, and I think a lot of other people do this too, or the people who do it well, in what exactly is going to be posted. I mean, I actually met with Allie, who's the Death to Stock co-founder, earlier today. We probably had a half-hour conversation about exactly how to edit each one of our photos so that they all look like the exact same edit, and maybe another half hour on what type of copy we write. And this is just for Instagram.
Wow.
So we said, like, I mean, we have to a T exactly how we edit every single photo. We have two tones for what we talk about as copy underneath that Instagram photo. One being nostalgic, connecting with memories, and the other one being lighthearted and fun. I mean, it takes a while to get your tone, but like, we spend a lot of time on it. I mean, we don't just post.
Yeah.
It sounds crazy. Like, but I mean, I know even on my personal Instagram, I delete photos about once a week because it doesn't fit within the looks of my grid. So I think you just have to get really detailed. I think it takes a while to find your voice. But I think you'd be surprised at what people who are doing something like Instagram really well, how much time they're really thinking about stuff. It doesn't seem like that, but you could spend an hour trying to make the perfect edit.
Who do you follow that, you know, kind of influences you and, you know, you look at and you just go, oh my gosh, they've.
Yeah. So there's a guy locally. We just did an Instagram meetup that I hosted about 2 weeks ago with some people, and that was awesome. And there's a guy locally named Big Man Japan. That's his handle, if you want to call him. He's a local Columbus guy. He was actually one of the big, like, early Instagrammers, so he has a pretty good following. But I think he's really specific about what he posts, and so I've actually talked to him a little bit about it, and that was interesting to hear. It's just, like, his mentality on the whole thing. There's some original guys, like With Hearts is another guy who I actually took his Skillshare class where he showed all the apps he uses to edit. I mean, he he does crazy stuff. Like, he really cares about his feed. But kind of bringing back to some of the topic we were talking about earlier, I'm always fascinated by some big brands. And if you look at someone like Red Bull, I don't think I can almost think of a single post. I don't think I can think of a single post where they included a can in their post. Really? And that says a lot. And maybe that's just on Instagram. Maybe some of their other ones do something else. But if you think about it like that, where they realize that Instagram isn't a channel for selling their cans, it's for telling the story of extreme athletes, I think it puts things... I mean, why do they have that guy jump from space? How does that connect with selling product, right? But that's what's really motivating to me. And I think it shows that idea of leading a movement and leading an inspiring idea of, you know, living life to your fullest. That's kind of what their thing is, you know.
So how can a small company, how can a, you know, one person or two person, you know, shop, you know, we can't typically fund people doing record-breaking space jumps.
I think they need to just think about how they give value. I mean, and we can get to the gold list here in a minute because that relates to this topic, but we don't ask for anything yet with Death to Stock. You just get high-quality images in your inbox. You know, so I think when people think about their email lists for their business or their social accounts, they need to think about how it's actually providing value and not think of it as a platform for PR. So I know a lot of people that either email every time they have news, like, hey, we got new customers, or we have, like, check out our latest work or something. That to me is like kind of like, it's kind of like PR. It's like, I don't really care that much about your story, you know, but if you're providing value, you're saying, hey, here's free images, here's a free ebook, you're telling interesting stories or you're being funny, like those actually add value to somebody. So no matter what you're doing, I would stick away from being a PR or creating PR type content because people don't care. And I would try to figure out how can I help my readers be better at their work, laugh, feel nostalgic, any of those things. And that's free. You don't have to do, you know, just find something easy. And that's kind of what the gold list is too. I don't, it's just, you know, hopefully a way for me just to give value to people through stories.
Yeah. Let's, that's a good transition. Cause I want to talk about the gold list. It's my new favorite, thing that I get each week. And
hey, thanks, man.
And so, each week you send out, a really fascinating story, and then you followed up with a really useful link. And I've got an email right here, your latest one, I'd like to read.
Sure.
We're going to get Garrison Keillor.
I love Garrison. Greyhound Companion fan. So you're speaking the right guy right now.
So I explore a set of train tracks by an overpass that face the city. Tie roping the rail, I put my hands out on either side for balance. I could probably take this track all the way to California if I wanted to. 233,000 miles. That's how many miles of train tracks there are in the U.S. I could get almost anywhere in the entire city from this spot without leaving the track. We're that connected. I follow the rail through a big overpass that shaded the sun. The walls were covered in graffiti, personal expressions, monikers, initials, and quotes like "on tap" or "any road" with a big bubble arrow stretched around it. I thought about all the paths you can use to share a story now. It started with legends created by the fireside. These stories were spread by travelers passing through town, expanding the tales like a long game of telephone. Then the printing press, then the microphone, then the publishing company, and now social platforms like Twitter, all used for spreading stories across the globe. We're all storytellers every day. We must pick the medium and the paths our stories will travel. The options are infinite now. Suddenly, a train rumbled in my direction, and I ran up the hill to watch it pass. Waving my arm and jumping up and down, I got a loud whistle as I cheered on the train's passing. In the blur, I saw graffiti on the sides of the train whizzing past, making its way to California for someone else to see. And then you followed up with, "This week's gold is our common mug." And, you know, what struck me is I've been following the list for a while, and I think it's only recently the stories have become more almost literary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, passages like that one just, you know, again, I think it goes back to, you know, they just break up your day. It's not the usual, you know, thing that ends up in your email box. Has that been a deliberate concept change over time? Is like what? When you started the gold list, and we can talk about it, the idea of, you know, where it came from. How has that progressed over the months you've been doing it?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny. So going back to what I was saying about a small firm, how are you going to add value? My idea was, hey, I get all these great links from friends and I see them on Twitter and stuff that are resources I can use for my business. I'm seeing all these every week. I've been saving them in this library. I should just share them with people. So the gold list started by just sending out a link every week saying, hey, have you seen this useful app? Have you seen this resource online? And it kind of progressed from there. But what's kind of funny is I started writing more and more, and that was for me, really. It was like, I was enjoying the writing piece of it. And I think I really wanted to set context for the link. So it wasn't just like, here's a link.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's funny about, I think I've been doing about 9-10 months now, but about halfway through, I checked the stats for the first time, and almost everybody opened the email, and almost nobody clicked on the resource.
Really?
And so it was kind of funny because I kind of thought that the reason, like, it was like, I'm sending this email, people are going to open it because of this link, and maybe, just maybe, they'll read what I read. And that was my approach, was like, I want to write, but like, this link is almost like bait for them to open. And then I realized it was actually the opposite, was most of the opens were for opens and not clicks.
Huh.
So that's where the shift happened, and it kind of encouraged me to write more. I still think that the gold, quote-unquote, piece of it is useful, but I think that I really enjoy the writing. I think for anybody out there, it's super important to write, even if you don't share with anybody, because it really solidifies your ideas. Even if it's a fictional type setting, I think, yeah, it's so important to write. I've gained so much from doing that. And it's nice to have people reading it too. But now I'm in this fun balance of how can I write a story that relates to the link? So this common mug had a story that really resonated with me about buying a product that you share with somebody across the country.
Hmm.
And so you buy the product in twos, and you send one, when you buy it, you ship one to a friend who's far away. And so that kind of is what got my brain turning, and I came out with this story, and it's a little bit off just the top of my head, but I try to relate it as much as I can to that link at the bottom too. So it's like an engaging story combined with a link that's maybe more of a utility than a interesting read, and then you can go ahead and check it out or whatever.
Yeah. Do you find, you know, sticking to a common theme, you know, and writing a story off of that theme and tying it into that gold, I mean, that's that kind of exercise, it's part of just making you a stronger writer just each week?
I think so. And I think the thing that I haven't got to yet that I'm really hoping over the next few years I can find is like a super honest voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really tough for people, and me included. I think it's really hard to be really honest online.
Yeah.
There's been, and I actually am kind of upset about it, but 2 weeks ago I wrote a post that I was going to share, and I sent it to a few people to look over, being like, is this okay to like say? And a few people, and this isn't to their discredit, were like, you should probably like change that. And so I didn't ship that post. I ended up rewriting it, which I do. I typically write about three posts before I send one. But I want to overcome that. I think I want to like be as honest and like genuine as I can. But it's tough. I think everyone has a hard time shipping something that they might feel like people are going to either not agree with, or they're wondering why you're talking about this topic, or just whatever it is. So I'm hoping that, you know, hopefully 6 months from now, I can be as honest as possible. But it's hard. I wish I'd ship that, you know, like, it's, I don't know, that's kind of, it's kind of funny.
Was it too personal? Was it, you know, just could have caused problems?
It was more like stupid thoughts that I actually had that might have been disrespectful to people. I don't think it was as much a personal thing. I do think there's other topics that become personal that people have a hard time sharing. But all of my favorite writers are like dead honest.
Yeah.
And I think that's what people like about them. And this even goes back to what we talked about at the beginning, was how do you stick out? How do you break up someone's day? And when everyone's writing a post that's six habits to X or five ways to utilize Twitter,
yeah,
when people just talk about something really personal and honest, I think it breaks up their day. It makes them think about things more than one of those posts. And so I'm hoping I can get there at some point and hit ship without thinking too much. But it's tough.
In a previous episode, I talked to Jonathan Longnecker, and him and his business partner, Nate Croft, they run 47 Media, and they started the Kick Awesome show and Kicktastic TV. And nice. What's interesting in their work is, yeah, they are very, their personalities are out there. They're not trying to cover up who they are or try to be corporate, or, you know, they've got weird hair and they definitely have a personality, and they seem to tackle sort of their public facing persona as fearless. And it's like, well, if you don't if you don't like us, then it's not going to work anyway, so
right,
cuz you'll
right.
be working with us.
I think people think to themselves, how can I have a unique brand online? And I think the trick is you already have a unique brand. You just have to expose it. So, you know, a lot of bloggers, I think, feel bad about promoting themselves or being too personal. But, like, that's actually what people are going to connect with. And the cool thing is everybody has that. You just need to be as honest and authentic as you can. And I guarantee you'll get readers off of that. Like you said, maybe it doesn't connect with everybody, but that's okay. And so I think everyone, I mean, anybody who wanted to have people read their work or see their work or whatever it is, I think just being authentic is really important. I think people will connect with whatever you have to say if you are actually being really honest.
Nice. Well, with that, I think we'll kind of end the episode right about here.
Hopefully that wasn't too all over the place. So
I think that's a great conclusion. Where can people, find your work, find more about Death of the Stock Photo, and see what you're up to?
Yeah. If they go to join.deathofthestockphoto.com, they can follow our email list and just get free photos every month, which would be cool. I'd be really happy if people connected with on Twitter. That's at DavidSherry36. I really like talking to new people and connecting with them. And as a sign off for every gold list email, I always ask how I can help. And that's an honest statement. I really like, even if it's just advice or sharing your new product or whatever it is, I'd be happy to either talk over what you're working on or help share or help you do whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. So.
Great. Well, David, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I had a lot of fun. That was awesome.